We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, and I don't know why I'm flipping the page away from what we're going to talk about.
We're going to start out talking about the Seattle Police Department.
The Mesh Network.
It is... It made an announcement this week that it's turning off its wireless mesh network, which can track the location of wireless devices throughout the Seattle area. And when I say wireless devices, I mean things like your cell phone, laptops, tablets like your iPad or your Nexus 7. Yes, the Seattle Police Department has been able to track people by their wireless devices all throughout the city of Seattle. And in fact, they have been expanding that network. Now, the SPD used money from the Department of Homeland Security to buy the network and put it in place, and they did it without any public review or any approval or review from the city council. They just kind of put it in place and then announced, oh, yeah, we do have that, by the way, and we're thinking of using it. And there was public outcry saying, how come there was no public review of this program? How come the city council didn't know about it until it was put into place? And the SPD said, well, we're not going to use it until the city actually comes up with a draft policy. The city council comes up with a draft policy on how it should be used and what it should be used for. And this week they announced, well, okay, we will turn it off because, after all, it's been on all this time. And I just have to say, well, if it's been on all this time, what have you been doing with it, you know? The fact that it was installed and turned on kind of concerns me and makes me wonder, you know, who's actually been watching what the SPD's been doing with this thing and what have they been doing with it. Of course, we've had no reports on that yet.
And credit to the Stranger for doing the initial article that got SPD to finally turn it off.
Yeah.
So it would have been nice if city council had done that.
Yeah, if the city council had actually followed up on that.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
Okay, well, speaking of follow-up, several developments this week regarding the election.
Yeah, a little bit of election follow-up here. There are still about 29,500 ballots or so left to be counted. That's about 5% of the vote in King County. But some races were finally decided this week. Yesterday, Richard Conlin conceded his race to Kshama Sawant for city council position 2. That was a big surprise. That, like we said last week, that was the nail biter of this election season was the Sawant versus Conlin race for city council, and the fact that she overtook him on Tuesday in Tuesday's ballot count, and now she, as of yesterday afternoon, she was 1,640 votes ahead of him, and Conlin finally, about 5:30 or so yesterday afternoon, sent out an email saying, you know, thanks for 16 years, and I wish her luck. So, yeah. So good news for the Kshama Sawant campaign.
Yeah, I think he had gone through his last pack of Tums.
So. Yeah, and so now we're seeing headlines in the local papers as well as the New York Times. I saw that they had an article about a socialist candidate winning in the city of Seattle, and this must be a first.
Yeah,
blah,
it's
blah,
making
blah.
National news.
Yeah, it's making national news. So that's kind of interesting. Too. What I find interesting is a lot of the media coverage of it has been not very complimentary of her politics, which I find kind of interesting too. As they don't necessarily mention a lot of the details, but the details they do mention, they can't exactly tell you why it's a bad thing that a socialist might believe in a $15 an hour minimum wage, for example, or why it might be bad to vote for a socialist if she believes in rent control. You know, there's no discussion of the actual politics or the actual reasons why people might think those are good ideas. You know, so I find that kind of interesting. You know, instead of just saying, you know, here's a socialist and then scratching your head and saying, why did people vote for her?
Yeah.
So that, I think that's kind of interesting. Also, in election follow-up, I want to talk for a minute or two about SeaTac Proposition 1. That's the $15 an hour minimum wage initiative in SeaTac. It's 49 votes ahead as of Friday afternoon, just kind of barely clinging to its lead. And I think if it still stays ahead, it will be a winner, but it's almost certainly going to trigger a recount because I'm sure the anti Prop 1 people are going to request a recount. They are taking Prop 1 to court, the anti-Prop 1 folks. That would be the Washington Restaurant Association, Alaska Airlines, and Philo Foods, which runs some of the concessions at SeaTac Airport. They filed an amended lawsuit in King County Superior Court this week, claiming that Proposition 1 is unenforceable because the airport is actually Port of Seattle property, not governed by the city of SeaTac. That's among other things that they're charging in the lawsuit. And initially, when you hear that, you think, oh, that makes sense. However, think about it for a minute. Sure, the airport is run by the Port of Seattle, but the airport is within the boundaries of the city of SeaTac. Even if the Port of Seattle actually operates and regulates how the airport is run, separating the two is a little bit like saying, you know, Seattle's sick leave law shouldn't apply to people who work in the downtown convention center because it's run by the Port of Seattle, or it shouldn't apply to people who work in the Bell Harbor Conference Center because even though it's on Seattle's waterfront, you know, it's run by the Port of Seattle. So I don't think that lawsuit's really going to go anywhere. But, you know, we'll see. Judges, sometimes they don't agree with that interpretation. So that's another election follow-up issue. Also, there's a couple of other things I want to talk about in regards to the election. The Seattle Prop 1, that's the public elections initiative, that is continuing to narrow its gap. It's about 2,416 votes behind as of Friday. So there's a possibility with 29,500 King County ballots still to be counted, there's a possibility it could catch up. And there are some folks who are pushing to get some volunteers together to go out and follow up on ballots that are being contested in the city of Seattle because of maybe there's a question about their signature. To try to get people to find out who's voted for Seattle Prop 1 for public elections and to get those people to contact King County to verify that, yes, that is my ballot, that is my signature. And I'll have some more information on that later. So that's some good news there that Prop 1's closing the gap and it may actually win. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see. At the state level, on the other hand, one initiative that people were watching very closely, I know I was, I-522, the GMO labeling campaign, that one also closed the gap pretty well. It narrowed it down to about 45,798 votes out of 1.7 million. So that gave the yes on I-522 group a 48.67% of the vote, way better than they had on Election Day. But unfortunately, there's not enough votes outstanding for that one to actually win. So it's I-522 is still going down to defeat, but it was a much, much closer race than it appeared on Election Day. So, you know, that's actually some fairly decent news for the folks who were for GMO labeling. It was defeated, but $22 million didn't defeat it resoundingly. It, you know, and it ran and it actually won in King County and won in many, many other particularly west of the mountains counties, too. So that's a little bit of good news there in spite of the defeat. On the other hand, voter turnout in King County was low. Only about 47% of the electorate actually filled out and mailed in their ballots. And overall state turnout was even lower. It was 45%. So I found that particularly interesting given that there were some pretty important things to be voted on, including the GMO labeling and some other things like the SeaTac proposition and some major city council races in Seattle, that voter turnout was that low.
All right. Well, one place where voter turnout wasn't low this week was with the Boeing machinists.
Yeah, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, District 751, voted this week on Boeing's contract extension offer, and they resoundingly rejected it by a two-thirds majority, pretty big and pretty solid majority. Again, the media covered a lot of it from Boeing's perspective, you know, and didn't talk at all about what the contract details were. I had to actually look for a national article in a national publication to find some information about what the actual contract details were in the media. Among the objectionable clauses that they turned down was a clause to freeze pensions and replace them with a less generous 401k, to freeze their pay for 1 year, then offer a 1% raise the next year, so they get a raise only every other year on top of a cost of living adjustment. And it would increase from 6 years to 16 years the amount of time it would take for new employees to reach their full pay grade. That would create a two-tier system of workers that would undermine the union, and it would be an effective across-the-board pay cut for all new hires. So they said, no, that's no good. And in addition, the company, Boeing, wanted a guarantee that the union wouldn't go on strike between now and 2024, effectively a 10-year no-strike clause. Now, I have to tell you, when a union votes in a no-strike clause, even for a short period of time, like 2 to 3 years, it's basically hamstringing your ability to even negotiate with the company, you know, because the strike is your ultimate tool. You know, when you're a union, it's your ultimate tool for negotiation. It's really the only power the workers have to win concessions from the company. So that was not going to go anywhere, a 10-year no-strike clause. And that was not mentioned at all in any of the reporting that I saw, particularly any of the local reporting on this Boeing contract offer. Now, Boeing, just to put this in perspective, what Boeing was asking the workers to do, Boeing has been making record profits, and in this year, its stock price has reached record highs. The price of its stock has never been higher, so Boeing shareholders are raking in the dough. Now, Citizens for Tax Justice this week calculated what Boeing's state and federal tax burden has been, you know, on these record profits. And here's what they found. Now, from 2003 to 2012, over the last decade for which we have complete information, Boeing made profits of a total of $35 billion in that 10-year period. They paid no state tax at all in any of the states where they have facilities. They paid no state income tax. They received rebates, tax rebates or gifts from these states of about $96 million in state income taxes from all the states where their facilities are. So they've been, you know, these states have been shelling out the dough, giving up revenue so that they can have Boeing facilities in their states. Now, that's not counting breaks on sales and property taxes, because, you know, in the state of Washington, we don't have a state income tax. We give Boeing breaks on their sales taxes and their property taxes and their use tax. Now, Washington State just gave Boeing the biggest, what is widely acknowledged as the biggest state tax giveaway in United States history to any one company, of $8.7 billion in combined tax breaks for the next 27 years. We just voted that in for them.
Well, our elected officials.
We
weren't asked.
In a hasty and unseemly manner, I should say. They did not sit down and debate it at all. Now, federal taxes, these are just state taxes I'm talking about. Federal taxes from in that same time period, that same 10-year time period from 2003 to 2012, Boeing paid no federal income taxes. Instead, they received federal tax rebates, again, gifts, of $1.8 billion in that time frame, where federal taxpayers, that's you and me and everybody in the United States, said, Boeing, you don't have to pay taxes. Here's a $1.8 billion gift for you to just make airplanes. Washington State, having just voted this in, is now, all of these politicians are now lining up and saying, oh, shame on you, to Boeing employees for voting down this contract offer, when in fact, you know, Boeing has enough cash that they could easily continue the current contracts into 2040 with their workers and not have any problem spreading some of their profits around, given the fact that that taxpayers are giving them gifts of money in order to operate as a business.
Well, and aren't those gifts there more than just for Boeing making airplanes? Boeing has a lot
Boeing
of
Boeing makes other things too. They make a lot of weapons programs.
Surveillance systems. They got their fingers in a lot of
They do.
Pies. All right. Anything else on Boeing?
No, let's move on.
Okay. Washington
Health Plan. Washington Health Plan Finder. I want to remind people that just because healthcare.gov, the federal website, is down and not working properly, doesn't mean that the state websites are not working. Now, if you live in a state that has its own state health care exchange, go to that state site and see if you can log in and look at your options, because in most cases, the state health care exchanges work far better than the federal one does, and they offer you some great options. The one exception to that really is Oregon. Oregon has not been able to get its health care exchange up online and working. They have people who you can call. They have a hotline you can call, and they have people filling out paperwork for you to help you make your decisions. But here in the state of Washington, wahealthplanfinder.org is the place to go, and it's good, and it's working very well. Washington is third among the states who've registered people in new health plans under the Affordable Care Act. California and New York are number one and two for the number of people they've registered, but surprisingly, Washington State is number three. Largely, I think, because we did a good job setting up our online exchange, and the state of Washington has been doing a good job of publicizing it as well, running commercials to remind people it's out there. Here's where you go. Here's how you use it. Unfortunately, that hasn't been able to happen for the federal exchange. All of the publicity currently about the federal exchange has been fixing problems with it, and that's negative publicity in terms of getting people to actually go to it and use it. Nationally, Republicans are making a big deal out of the fact that only about 106,000 people have enrolled nationwide so far under the Affordable Care Act. But I just want to point out that an additional 975,000 people nationwide have completed the online registration and looked at their options, even though they haven't made a choice of a plan yet under the Affordable Care Act. So that's about 1 million people who have logged in, registered, and started the process. Now, the Obama administration has set a goal of about 7 million people to register under the Affordable Care Act by the end of 2014. So having 1 million people look at it in the first month and a half to 2 months is not a bad number, you know. The media is saying that the actual deadline is March 31st. Well, the actual deadline, if you don't want to pay a penalty, is March 31st. But you know how people are. It's the folks who are responsible will sign up first, and then a whole bunch of people will register at the last minute in March.
The rest of us will do it later.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of people will rush to register in the last 6 weeks, you know, late February into March, and then there'll be stragglers, people who didn't realize or thought the penalty, it'd be okay to pay the penalty, and realize that they don't like it, and then they'll come and register later. So that's kind of the thinking is behind that it's going to be a lot of people who register next year rather than this year. So really, about 1 million people is a pretty good number, even though the Republicans are making a big deal and saying it's only about 100,000. Now, another thing that the Republicans are making a big deal about is the 1.3% of Americans whose cheap, insufficient policies are being canceled by insurance companies. Now, I just want to point out that, yes, President Obama made a promise. It was a general blanket promise that was made to a general blanket question about that was asked him about won't people be kicked off plans, off insurance plans. He said, oh, no, if you like your insurance, you'll be able to keep it. I'm sure he was thinking, as I was thinking when he made that comment, that people who are covered by their employer's insurance, you know, will be able to keep their insurance policies. People who have full coverage with decent benefits will be able to keep their policies, and that's true. It's the people who, and he wasn't thinking about, and this was actually pointed out at the time, no, that's not true for everyone, and it was widely discussed at the time he made that comment. No, it's not going to be true for everyone, because there are a number of people who have these catastrophic coverage policies that don't cover very much. Those people will be kicked off. And that was discussed at the time. So that's not new. This is not new. And it should not be a surprise to anybody. And I just want to point out that these folks are who are relatively healthy, think they don't have any problems, and who think they're covered, but they're really not. Those folks have been a big part of the reason why our current system has not been working. because people who are relatively healthy, who buy cheap, crappy policies, who think that they're covered and they're not, are really cheating both themselves and they're cheating everybody else. Because if they did pony up and pay for better policies with better coverage, then the price of those policies would come down and it would be cheaper for everyone. That's the way the system is supposed to be working. And this is what President Obama should have said about this whole issue. He should have come out and said, okay, here's the deal, folks. You know, when I said that, I meant, you know, people with full coverage. I didn't mean people who have these catastrophic policies that don't cover anything. You know, these policies that don't pay for routine checkups. Routine checkups are the main way that you catch things that are developing, like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, cancer. You know, people who think they're healthy, who have these policies that don't cover anything except catastrophic care, they could be developing heart disease. They could be developing cancer. They could be developing type 2 diabetes and not know it until they actually get really, really sick, go to the doctor and find out that their crappy insurance isn't going to cover it. And that's a big part of the reason those people have to give up those policies and buy real, pony up, buck up, and buy real insurance, essentially. And that's what he should have said. You know, you're 1.3% of the population, folks, buck up and buy real insurance. But he didn't. Instead, he caved in. He essentially said, okay, I understand for political reasons the Democrats have elections next year. So, okay, those folks who don't want to buck up and buy real insurance, they can keep their crappy policies for another year. That was the wrong thing to do, partially because he can't make that promise. He made another promise that he can't keep. Essentially, he can't make that promise. It's state insurance commissioners who have to look at those crappy policies, catastrophic coverage policies, and rate them and approve them and tell people whether or not they can keep them. A lot of state commissioners or insurance commissioners are not going to do that. In fact, in the state of Washington, our insurance commissioner said, no, I don't care what President Obama just said. You're not going to be able to keep your crappy catastrophic coverage policy. You've got to buck up and buy real insurance. And that's what Obama should have said.
All right. Anything else on healthcare?
There's a couple of other things I want to talk about it. Enrollment in Medicaid has been low, too, because of the malfunctioning of the healthcare.gov federal exchange. And that's a shame because a lot of the folks who really need coverage are people who are going to qualify for Medicaid. If you live in a state that has its own insurance exchange and you think you may qualify for Medicaid, you should be going to that state exchange. If you live in a state that doesn't have its own healthcare exchange, and you go, it's okay to go to healthcare.gov. If it tells you that you qualify for Medicaid, you should go directly to your state Medicaid department and fill out their paperwork. Because the healthcare.gov, one of the biggest bugs in it, one of the worst ways that it's been malfunctioning is that it's not forwarding that Medicaid information to the state Medicaid offices like it's supposed to be. States manage and run Medicaid, not the government. And even though the federal government is paying for the expansion of Medicaid, it's the states that manage the enrollment. And healthcare.gov has not been forwarding people's information to the states. So even if you've already been there and it's told you that you qualify for Medicaid and you assume it's going to, and it tells you it's going to transfer your data to the state, it hasn't done that. And just, you should just assume it hasn't done that. And you should go to your state Medicaid office and begin the enrollment process all over again. That's unfortunately been the case, and people will have to do that. I just wanted to make sure that people know that. And that kind of leads me to talk a little bit about the Republicans and the media making a big deal about who's been signing up so far, that they're making a big deal out of the fact that a lot of older uninsured people and people who qualified for Medicaid are the main folks who have been signing up for healthcare. For healthcare under the Affordable Care Act. And I want to point out that that just makes sense. Again, psychologically, the people who are most desperate, who are most responsible, who are thinking the most about their healthcare are the ones who are going to sign up first, that it's early days yet. And the folks who are relatively healthy are going to sign up at the last minute, like I said, before, you know, in February and March and after.
All right. Moving on, Hawaii.
Yeah, some really good news this week. Hawaii became the 16th state to legalize gay marriage. Now, this is particularly important because back in 1993, Hawaii's state Supreme Court was the very first court in the nation to rule that refusing marriage to gay men and lesbians was a form of discrimination. So the fact that Hawaii has now come forward and joined the ranks of other states that have legalized gay marriage is really good, since that court decision in Hawaii was the one that provided the most fuel for activists early on to make a push to make legalizing same-sex marriage at the state level their main focus. So some really good news this week.
All right. And briefly, Iran.
Yeah, a lot of information in the news this week, or a lot of talk in the news this week about the nuclear deal that fell through with Iran. And it was covered widely in the international press as well as here, because the United States was not the only nation that was negotiating with Iran to try to get a deal for them to freeze their enrichment program. The way it was portrayed in the U.S. media, however, was that Iran rejected the deal, that it was Iran's fault that the deal fell through. But if you looked abroad, if you read the British press at all, and even the French press, what you found out was that the U.S. proposal was that the proposal was scuttled by France. That the proposal was one written up by the U.S. delegation. It was for Iran to freeze enrichment for 6 months and in exchange get some of the sanctions lifted. But at the 11th hour, most of the negotiations throughout the entire negotiating period was between the different Western countries that were trying to put together a proposal they could all agree on that they would then submit to Iran. At the 11th hour, France stepped forward and objected. They got greedy, essentially. They said, oh, we want to put tougher language in there. You know, if Iran looks like they're going to agree to this, then we want them to agree to the fact that they have no right to enrich uranium. We want them to give up their saying that they have a right to enrich uranium, even if it's only for industrial uses, for electricity generation, in other words, not enriching to the level the higher level for nuclear weapons. And we want Iran to agree that it's going to stop all work on its heavy water reactor at Arak, ARAK, one of their facilities. Big nuclear complexes. And so, you know, they essentially stepped in, changed the proposed agreement at the 11th hour, toughened it up to essentially got greedy to try to get Iran to agree to much more than had been discussed earlier. And then when it was submitted to Iran at the last minute, they read through it and they said, wait, this has changed. This is way tougher than anything we had agreed on. I can't, you know, I'm not empowered. And the Iranian delegate said, I'm not empowered to agree to all this. You know, I would have to discuss this with my, you know, very reasonable objection given the circumstances. And so, of course, it was blown up in the media as Iran rejected out of hand a very reasonable proposal, when I would have to say, no, the terms were changed at the last minute, toughened up quite a bit, and Iran really didn't have a chance to agree to what I thought would have been a reasonable document. So just a little bit of correction there to what the media reported.
All right. And we have a big list of events.
Lots of events.
Starting, I have the first one starting with a pancake feed that actually started at 8 o'clock this morning, fundraiser for Nicholsville. It's currently happening at Keystone Church. It's going to keep going on till 11 this morning, so Keystone Church, 5019 Keystone Place. That's where the Friday night meaningful movies take place. Wednesday morning, breakfast launch for Washington Fair Trade Coalition's Education Fund. It's happening from 7:30 to 9 a.m. at the IAM District Lodge 751, which is at 921 15th Place South.
On Wednesday evening from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at downstairs at Town Hall, Rebecca Sive speaking on A Woman's Guide to Winning Any Office from the PTA to the White House, How Women Can Get Elected. That's, again, downstairs at Town Hall at 8th and Seneca from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. on Wednesday.
Also happening Wednesday, Washington Incarceration Stops Here, facilitating a community workshop on the school-to-prison pipeline. That's happening from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the UW School of Social Work. Room 306.
On Thursday, Yuri Gnezi, speaking on the hidden power of the economics of everyday life. He's a behavioral economist who's known for his field studies in schools, factories, and communities, examining everyday life aspects of economics. He's speaking on Thursday from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. downstairs at Town Hall, again at 8th and Seneca.
Also Thursday, talk on refusing to be enemies, Palestine and Israel nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation, happening at 7 o'clock at the Common Good Cafe. Talking as we do every week with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State online at www.eatthestate.org.